Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that's underperforming expectations. My name's Corey Hazelhurst, I'm a partner of propaganda in Steve Haynes.
Hi Corey.
Bridget and John are out foraging for food, so it's just us two in the bunker this week. However, they are local politicians, so it's quite they only survive on votes.
So they may be not coming back then, considering Labour's current current situation. So that last podcast may be the last one you ever hear of Bridget and John, dear listeners.
But we are reflecting on the local election results this week, and we're going to try and tread the fine line between baseless speculation and reasoned analysis and try and work out what these results actually mean for the general election. Do stick with us. We're recording this on Friday evening. Andy Street was only elected Mayor of the West Midlands and about an hour or two ago, probably 2.5 hours ago. We're going to have a special Birmingham Fabians podcast analysing those results in a little bit more detail. What I do want to say now, actually, is that the model that we put together was only about 4,000 votes off. So that's probably about the only thing I've been right on in the past 2 years. But let's have a look at the big picture stuff for the local elections. Tories dominant, won the Tees Valley mayoralty, which is a bit of a political earthquake, won the West of England mayoralty, which was a three-way marginal with then Labour and Lib Dems, did win the West Midlands, which was too close to call almost all the way through, but it's a very, very big result for them in an area where 21 out of 28 MPs are Labour. In Scotland, they won seats, which is unheard of in our political lifetimes. They won the most deprived ward in Britain, didn't they? And a few other council seats up there as well. Most of those came at the expense of UKIP, who lost, I think, all but one of their council seats that they were defending. And in 2 years' time, when Britain leaves the EU, that one councillor will be UKIP's most senior political representative. So future leader there, random UKIP councillor, I think. Labour won the mayoralty of Manchester and Liverpool.
Well, Andy Burnham won.
Andy Burnham is the undisputed king of the north.
That's brilliant. I was going to say, you know he's from the north.
I had no idea who he's from the north.
He never mentions it at all.
I've not heard him mention that in quite a while, actually. There is an alternative universe in which he's now leader of the opposition and Labour's 15 points ahead in the polls, which then evaporates in the final 6 weeks of an election campaign.
The minute anybody scrutinises him.
Pretty bad results generally for Labour across councils as well. For instance, they lost Glasgow Council for the first time in 35 years. A quote from a Professor Will Jennings who said that there are arguably no crumbs of comfort for Labour whatsoever. Although maybe it wasn't as disastrous as it could have been in Scotland and Wales, it wasn't really very good either.
No, I mean, I think when you look at the results, especially in Wales, I think potentially the true disaster could be awaiting on June the 8th, in that there are a lot, for some reason, Wales attracts a lot of independent candidates standing in local elections, which has muddied the waters in terms of actually looking at the total kind of swing. When you also throw in the fact that really, Wales is in a bit of an odd position where there's no real singular opposition to Labour there. You've got Plaid Cymru, you've got the Conservatives, and in some areas you've got the Lib Dems. There's no one real focus or repository for that anti-Labour vote. There's maybe some cold comfort to be taken from that. Maybe that vote will be split a bit too much to actually enable a full disaster in Wales. But at the same time, it's still very, very likely that Wales is going to go very badly for Labour at the general election.
What seems to have been happening is that it is the Tories who are hoovering up votes from other parties. Mm-hmm. They're winning votes from UKIP, they're winning votes from Labour, they're winning votes from the Lib Dems as well. We didn't talk about the Lib Dems in that big picture stuff. They had a pretty mixed night, didn't they? So
yeah,
they had a night loss of about 30 or 50 councillors or something.
I think the last number I saw, no idea if this is the final one, was about 38.
I think your point's really interesting. If we do see the Tories almost becoming that anti-Labour vote by winning votes from all the other parties, maybe even Plaid voters as well, then it could go very, very wrong. I mean, there is that one poll from YouGov which came out which put the Tories ahead of Labour in terms of votes in Wales for the first time since, I think, Owen Glendower or something. It was a long time ago anyway. That looks like one rogue poll at the moment, but I mean, there's 5 or 6 weeks to go. These are our local elections based on the 2013. It tries to take into account for the fact that there's often votes in, say, mainly Tory areas or maybe Labour areas, and tries to average them out a little bit. And so those projected national shares see the Conservatives on 38%, which is their best result since 2008. It has Labour on 27% of the vote, which is its worst since 2010. Had the Lib Dems on 18%, which is their highest since 2010. So, or, as we say, it's mixed. A net loss of councillors, but a pretty decent result. And UKIP on 5%, which is their lowest ever. To put that into perspective, last year it was 12%. It's not looking good, really, is it?
No, it certainly isn't looking very good for Labour. There was an interesting article by Stephen Bush from the New Statesman, who has done some analysis looking at the gap between local elections and general elections in terms of the actual votes. And what he found was, unsurprisingly, there's a bit of oppositions tend to kind of drop down a little bit from local elections to general elections. So if you are a political party and you're polling 25% at the local elections at a certain point, you would normally expect to drop 2 or 3 points down when it comes to the general. This is not a normal kind of year for the local elections. We've got a general election in a couple of months. So Stephen Bush went in and looked at some close examples, as close as we can get to examples of this happening previously. And there's a few here and there. And the general thing he found was the same thing basically happens. So what we're potentially seeing in the local elections results is potentially flattering the Labour vote share, flattering the Lib Dem vote share, and almost certainly flattering the UKIP vote share. So it could be that things can only go downhill from here for Labour.
There's been a lot of talk of trying to work out how representative local election results are of general elections. There's been some work by Anthony Wells of YouGov looking at the differences in voter intentions in the local elections of 1983 and 1987. The problem with those is, I mean, they were both May local elections, June general elections like this one. The main difference, though, is that there, Thatcher saw the local elections, saw they were pretty good, and then called the general. Election. In 1992, which is the last time we had local and general election results within a month of each other, the general election in 92 was a month before the local elections. And so I think Labour did a bit worse than the locals, as you'd probably expect.
Having just lost.
Yeah, just lost, a bit depressed, all that kind of thing. I think you're right, it probably does underestimate Tory vote share. If you put the figures into Sky News, crunched their figures, I don't think the same ones that we've just quoted, but the ones that Sky crunched, they had a Tory majority of 48.
Seems far too low.
I mean, as I said last week on the general election special that we did, the most optimistic view I can see is a Tory majority of 30, and then, I mean, anywhere from there to landslide country. I mean, the leads that we see in the local election polls, they are bigger than Thatcher's in 83 and Thatcher's in 87 as well. And obviously both of those were three-digit landslide wins. So I think some might try and spin this as well. The polls say that there's a 20-point Tory lead in the polls, and there's only an 11-point Tory lead now. The margin hasn't halved in a week. What we're just seeing, I think, is the bad news in the polls reflected in those election results.
Yeah, possibly. Although what should be taken into account with that as well is that actually the polls for Labour have been ticking upwards slightly, which again, when you think about it, kind of makes sense. We're now into the period where people are actually starting to pay attention to politics. So rather than switching off when they're watching the 10 o'clock news, whenever somebody from Labour's on, they're actually going to be paying a bit more attention to it. To be fair, Labour have in many ways gotten their game together a bit more, announcing policies which are broadly speaking quite popular. Some issues around Diane Abbott's interview and things like that, around her funding for various things, but we'll gloss over that for the time being.
We'll have
another entire episode on Diane Abbott.
Wow. The online marketer listeners, if ever you...
I know. But because people are paying attention and this, and Labour are actually seemingly being a bit more competent and getting policies as their main kind of focus, and people are being more sharply reminded that it is a choice between Labour and the Tories, you know, we would expect that their numbers have been eke up as they have been.
Yeah, I think you'd expect to see a lot of people trying to shift back to Labour. It's possible that Labour's vote share, their vote tally, might well end up being the same as in 2015, or similar. If we assume that this election, for the most part, is going to be a consolidation for Labour to try and hang on for seats it's got, that in one sense is positive if they can try and replicate that 2015 vote share. Of course, the problem is that the Tories are winning votes from UKIP, possibly winning votes from Lib Dems, maybe winning votes from Labour as well. But I mean, UKIP had, I think, 4 million votes, didn't they, in the 2015 election?
Yeah.
Judging by the polls, backed up by those local election results, UKIP support is falling by about half. Now, we'd expect the bulk of those are probably going to go to the Conservatives. Some people are calling UKIP as almost like a gateway drug. You can go from Labour to UKIP to Conservative.
I mean, there might be some kind of truth to that, but equally there's plenty of evidence of Labour supporters who have always been Labour supporters just making that initial jump to the Conservatives just because of Corbyn, or just because of how they perceive Corbyn to be. The real thing here is just the fact that UKIP voters are going Conservative demonstrates that really the only way for the Labour to win elections is by taking votes off the Conservatives. That is the long and short of it. You can talk about progressive alliances all you want, you can talk about or whatever. At the end of the day, if you want to get a Labour majority, you've got to take votes off of the Conservatives directly.
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, the plan is hopefully to try and do a Fabian podcast with LJ looking at the idea of a progressive alliance, just so I can prod LJ with a stick, I think, and troll him for a little bit for half an hour. I suppose the other consolation maybe for Labour figures is turnout, that obviously turnout in a general election is going to be probably about twice as large as it would be in a local. The turnout in the mayoral elections, there were about 7 or 8 mayoral elections on Thursday. That ranged from anywhere between 21% in Tees Valley, which maybe explains the Tory victory, to, I think, 34%. And the West Midlands one was in the middle. That was about 26-27%.
I think the other kind of thing of note that Labour are going to take from this is that in areas up in Manchester, so for instance in Withington, which was formerly the seat of John Leach, Lib Dem, he's contesting that seat again, I believe. The Lib Dems have been throwing a lot of their time and energy into that area. From what I've seen online, Labour are no longer concerned about that. They've started pushing their time and energy off the back of the results up there into other areas. Potentially, one small crumb of comfort from this actually is that the few areas that do still exist, which are Labour, Lib Dem facing, are not necessarily going to end up with a Lib Dem victory, which certainly in the West Midlands with Yardley, where John Henning is once again heading off against Jess Phillips. Given what I've seen, I would now expect Jess Phillips probably to maintain her seat. If the Lib Dems were actually in a position where they were taking significant votes off of Labour, that would be a very different story. But if, as we can kind of see from the results, the Lib Dems are gaining votes, but they're not necessarily gaining them all in the right places to make a massive kind of surge.
So there's a couple of things there. One about Yardley and maybe one about tactical voting. So there's an interesting interview in The New Statesman with Jess Phillips. She was saying if she is re-elected, then she expects there to be... she'll be up against the Tories in 2022 and they would be their main rivals. At the moment, it's almost but not quite a three-way marginal, isn't it? She overtook John Hemming only just about a couple of thousand votes, I think, in 2015. And the Conservatives were a slightly distant third. And I think you're right, Jess Phillips is... she's not going to have any problem answering the Corbyn question. I mean, she's been one of the most outspoken Labour MPs against Corbyn. She's got quite a high media profile, which I think means she had a lot of Labour activists come up from London for her launch. I know there's Labour activists in Birmingham wanted to get involved. Jess is probably the figure they're going to go to, I reckon. So she's got that name recognition that means she'll get a lot of activists, and that can only be a good thing. What happens in 5 years' time if she's up against a Tory marginal
is a very different question.
Definitely.
But then potentially there's a whole host of Lib Dem vote to squeeze even further. But yeah, that is for the general election after this one. Planning ahead for listeners.
We'll still be in the bunker, maybe. And the other thing, I suppose, is about tactical voting, and that's where maybe a bit about the Progressive Alliance come in, is that 2015 was a really skewed general election, and we've got a podcast on polls coming up, but one of the reasons why the polls didn't quite predict the 2015 election result is that there was such a big mismatch between the votes cast for particular parties and the seats they actually got. So obviously we talked before, UKIP got 4 million votes and they got one MP. The SNP got 45% of the votes in Scotland. They ended up with 45 MPs. It's just one thing that you couldn't really factor in the polls, I don't think. I think that means what's going to happen now is you're going to have a lot of tactical voting issues and questions. And that's where some of the Progressive Alliance stuff kicks in, where the Lib Dems have tried to help Caroline Lucas in Brighton. The Greens have tried to help Wes Streeting in Ilford, I think he's standing. And they've helped
Ilford North, I believe.
And I think they've also stood down on a couple of other Labour seats. Obviously, that Progressive Alliance talk is counterbalanced by the fact that Thangam Debonair, who is a Labour MP in Bristol, is also the Greens' main target seat. That doesn't really help the idea of a Progressive Alliance. But I think what you are going to find is there's going to be a lot of tactical voting where voters attempt to coalesce around a particular candidate, given that they don't actually have the convenience of a proper voting system to allow that to do so.
I mean, yes and no. My somewhat hedging of the bet response to that.
Could you hedge any more bets?
Well, I am a former Lib Dem, remember.
No, I'll give you a pledge to sign if you like.
Yeah, it's fine, it's cool. I'll just give me a pledge, I'll take some pictures with it. But yeah, overall, I think that whilst there are almost certainly movements to try and encourage tactical voting, there's been plenty of things which have gone round on social media, on Facebook, basically saying, here are all the places you should vote if you're... Here's who you should vote for if you're in this constituency. Here's who you should vote for in this other constituency, whether it Lab, Lib, Green, whatever. Or anti-Tory, or make sure the Tories don't win these seats. We've seen this sort of thing actually happen before. It was one of the reasons the Lib Dem numbers of seats shot up in 1997.
A Progressive Alliance that worked.
Was tactical voting to kick out the Tories. The problem is, there's a general... correlation between Labour doing well at the polls and the Lib Dems doing well at the polls. Possibly because I think if you break the British electorate down into its core kind of motives, it ends up in either one of two moods. A mood for a right-wing government or a mood for a left-wing government. So if they're being optimistic, as they were in 97, say, you know, they're more likely to vote, they're going to vote left-wing. And in reality, it doesn't matter necessarily if it's the Liberal candidate or the Labour candidate, they're voting for the left-wing candidate that's going to win. In any other time, they're going to go for a right-wing candidate because they're not feeling optimistic or whatever. You know, you can have all kinds of debates about what would cause people to do what or make the electorate feel what way. But I don't think we're in a period where we're going to see people flocking to vote for left-wingers.
You don't think this is a happy, optimistic period still?
I'm afraid I do not, unless you're Dan Hannan.
One of the many things that categorises Dan Hannan is his ability to stay optimistic in the face of...
all reality and facts.
Any kind of national trauma. The Tories are almost becoming a one-man right-wing machine. Maybe in 2015 it was more the right-wing vote got split between Tories and UKIP. Mm-hmm. But because the Tories have got their tanks planted firmly on UKIP's lawn, as we talked about in the last podcast, they are hoovering up UKIP's vote. Which maybe brings us on to one small thing we could talk about, which is that collapse of the UKIP vote. How much of it is, do you think, down to a change of leadership? I mean, do you think that if Nigel Farage was UKIP leader, they would still be in the pickle they're in, given that Theresa May's basically nicked all their policies?
So I think they'd still likely be in a pickle, but I'm not necessarily sure it would be quite so stark. I think Farage, still as leader, wouldn't have abated the fact that, you know, they don't have a raison d'etre anymore. But Farage is a lot more charismatic than Paul Nuttall. He's a lot more media friendly. He's a lot better at getting attention drawn to himself, for better or worse. And at the same time, if Farage was leader, maybe Farage stands in Stoke, the Stoke Central election by election, then you don't have the entire farce that is Paul Nuttall's background and over Hillsborough, the fake CV, claiming to be a footballer when he wasn't. All of that stuff doesn't come out because it doesn't matter, in which case UKIP aren't as tarnished as a brand. All in all, as I say, I don't think they're staying at the same kind of levels they were hitting in 2015, but they're probably the drop-off is probably less steep, but steep enough to for people to be having the kind of conversations that we're having anyway about, is this the end of UKIP?
Hmm. And the interesting thing is that in the West Midlands, where they got, I think, about 16% of the vote in the general election last year, they didn't finish third in the mayoral election, where I think most people expected them to. It was actually the Lib Dem candidate, Beverly Nielsen, who finished third. Now, granted, maybe there was a bit of a Remain bonus vote for her, maybe because it's a supplementary people can vote tactically. Also, she was quite a good candidate, which helps.
I mean, it could also just be the fact that, again, maybe those UKIP voters just went straight for Andy Street.
Maybe.
Maybe the performance that he had, which got him so, you know, in the first round, which was very, very strong for a Conservative, that maybe that was the root cause of it. Maybe that's where the UKIP vote went.
Yeah, potentially. I think that basically means I can't really see them being any sort of viable political force within about 12 months. But then they've won the main battle anyway, so at some point we should probably have a... It reminds me of the podcast we did on the Overton Window and talked about the success of the Greens and how they changed politics. Maybe UKIP is a wonderful example of how you shift that Overton Window
to the right
without really having any seats or influence or power.
Yeah, I think you're probably right there, and there probably is an awful lot to actually be said about UKIP and where it goes and what impact it has moving forward, because in one way or another, UKIP have been a part of the political landscape in the UK for decades. The fact that they've suddenly collapsed and dropped off is a very significant change, and it's the sort of thing that dissertations are going to be written about in the near future, I reckon.
I think so, but we'll save any gloating until the 9th of June. We're premature before that. As I said, we're going to have a Birmingham Fabians podcast. We'll talk about the West Midlands campaign in a little bit more detail. We're going to have a podcast out over the next week just talking about the campaign so far. And then we'll be back on our normal time next Sunday, and we'll have a podcast out about those polls that are coming in predicting our elections. Our theme tune is Plucky Good Times by Dave Depper, and that's available on freemusicarchive.org. And our logo is designed by James Cram. You can follow him on Twitter @JamesCram. I'm @PaperbackWriter.
I'm @CentreRadical.
Happy canvassing!